Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Rolling Stone Show here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Steve Godwin, and over this next hour, I'll be reading various articles about music, politics, and culture from Rolling Stone magazine. We're going to start tonight in the subculture section. In the last show, I had to stop halfway through an excerpt from a book called The Last Counterfeiter, about a man named Art Williams, who was an expert counterfeiter, and he ended up going to prison, not once, but twice. And the second time he went, he also went with his son, who he had taught the craft to also. This time he's out, he has a girlfriend, and he had tried to go straight, but it was a lot easier to go back to counterfeiting. So he arranged a loan of $100,000 from some gangsters in Cincinnati. He found all the equipment he needed, and he put it all together in a little spot in Miller Beach, where he didn't think he'd be watched, and was just getting ready to print, but he was lacking one more thing. He needed some fluorescent ink, and that has just arrived. That's where we'll pick up the story now. Thanks to his unfailing talent for complicating his life, Art had not mentioned to Sarah that he was about to counterfeit again, or that Cincinnati gangsters were into him for $100,000. "They were calling me on the secure phone, sweating me," says Art. "It had been 6 months, and I didn't have much money left." Art ceased operations and avoided his Miller Beach spot for 2 weeks. Conveniently, just as the feeling that he was being watched faded, his fluorescent ink arrived. He picked it up at the safe house, and his plan was to stop by his apartment for a quick nap before heading off to his printing hole. "I set the ink on the counter," he remembers, "and I go to the bedroom, and I come back, and my son's standing there looking at it." Since leaving the halfway house, Art's son, Little Art, had been on a far more stable trajectory than his father. After working various jobs as a janitor, car dealer, and even an industrial press operator, he obtained his commercial driver's license. He was now driving a truck and sharing an apartment with his girlfriend. He hadn't seen his father in weeks and had the day off, so he figured he'd drop in on his old man. "Motherfucker, you've been lying to us this whole time," Little Art shouted. "This is what you've been doing?" The moment was an uncanny reversal of the confrontation that had led to Art's arrest almost 10 years earlier, except this time his son had caught him in the act of counterfeiting. As Big Art puts it, he went berserk. Perhaps because the circumstances were so similar, Little Art's visceral reaction was to again flee the house, and once more his father chased after him to try to get him to talk. This time they both had cars, but Little Art wasn't trying to escape. He made sure his father followed him right back to 31st and Shields, to the exact location where he'd been arrested 9 years earlier. Then he got out of the car and waited. "You remember this spot?" he barked when his father joined him, pointing to the curb. "I remember you sitting there, crying. I went to prison with you, fucker." Art stammered that he'd been trying to live clean ever since his release, that nothing seemed to be working out, and that he didn't know what else to do with himself. He could feel the weakness of his words the moment they left his mouth. "Don't know what to do with yourself? Get a fucking job like the rest of us, jagoff," Little Art countered. He told his father that he should prepare to go back to prison because he was going to tell his mom, who was still a Chicago police officer, what he had seen. Then he got back in his car and drove off. Art raced back to his apartment in a panic. Sarah would soon be dropping by after teaching her classes, and for all he knew, his son was now informing on him to his cop mother. Continuing the operation now was unthinkable. Even if Little Art kept his secret, what kind of message would it send if he continued? He'd put himself in an impossible situation. Counterfeiting, his go-to solution for all his problems, was the problem. Art found himself driving to the car dealership of his friend Jimmy Pops Saklamathis. Pops was there behind his desk, his usual cheerful self, but he saw right away that Art was in distress. Oh, he was a wreck, Jimmy remembers. He was agitated and he was looking for guidance. He told me that he'd fucked up bad, and I gathered that meant he'd slipped, probably counterfeited, but he didn't get into details. Today's the only day you need to worry about, Jimmy said to Art. Whatever's going on, change what you can today. Art decided on the change he would make. He would drive to Cincinnati and tell his gangster backers that they weren't getting their product. Before he left, he told Sarah that he was in trouble and that he needed to go to Cincinnati to deal with the situation. Art didn't mention that he might not be coming back. The gangsters he had long dealt with in Chicago were certainly capable of killing, but Art had always enjoyed a degree of protection because people there could vouch for him. He had no idea how the Cincinnati gangsters would react upon learning that he didn't have their money, but the long drive gave him plenty of time to wonder if the reason his old counterfeiting mentor, Pete Da Vinci, had disappeared years ago was because he had taken a similar one-way trip. Art's contact in Cincinnati was the equivalent of what the Italian mafia would call a captain. He'd made the initial deal with Art, with permission from the gang leader, who Art had never met. Art had told the captain only that he needed to meet, without going into any details. When they arrived at their spot, a fried chicken restaurant, for all the captain knew, Art was bringing him counterfeit. "Listen, I'm being watched, and I don't have the money," Art told him. "All I have in this trunk is my fucking art, my paintings. Here, I'll show you." Art opened up the back of his little BMW's trunk, where he had four paintings. The largest and most impressive was a 72-inch vertical of the 1996 New Note in black and silver. The other three were modified versions of military payment certificates, a form of currency the U.S. once used to pay troops who were overseas. "I've had some shows, but this is a tough business to get into, and that's all I want to do, be an artist," Art continued, his voice cracking. "This is all I can give you right now because they're watching me. You can do whatever you want with me, I get it, but this is all I have." "All right, calm down, I understand," said the captain. He knew Art well enough to know about his dreams of being an artist, but logically concluded that it would be best if Art himself explained to his superior why all he had for him were paintings of money. "We'll go see him," he told Art. Art was about to get back in his car to follow the captain, but the captain told him to move the paintings into his truck. He was going to drive them. "That made me nervous," recalls Art. "That left me no way out." They drove to a large warehouse in one of the city's industrial zones. When Art walked in, it was full of people who he assumed were gangsters and their friends. The captain led him to a back area that had been converted into a music studio, where there were fewer people, including the boss. He was thin, well-built, bald, with a little scruff, and he talked clean, says Art. He also had that watchful gleam in his eye. Art told the capo the same thing he'd told the captain. He was being watched, and he couldn't say when, if ever, he'd be able to complete the job due to his notoriety. He had nothing to give the capo except his paintings. "I can tell you this much," Art added. "I will make it as an artist. I'll be a great artist." If he was going to go out swinging, he was going to swing big. The capo studied him intently. He had likely seen men beg for their lives before, but this was almost certainly new. "Bring me the paintings," he said. Art and the captain ran out to the truck and carried them in. Art arranged them against the studio wall where there was good light. The gang leader studied them. What calculations the boss made are known only to him. He, of course, knew that Art was a famous counterfeiter and that he had never ratted out anyone. He also knew that Art had come to him, and if it was true that Art was being watched, there was the possibility that he was being watched as well. Lastly, he seemed to like what he saw. "Okay," he told Art. "Leave these here and go be an artist." "It was the weirdest moment of my life," Art says of squaring his debt to the gangster with his paintings. Technically, it was also his first big sale as an artist, 4 paintings for $100,000 and his life. He drove back to Chicago with an empty trunk, grateful that he wasn't stuffed inside it with a bullet in his skull. The first thing he did when he got home was hug Sarah. Then he dismantled the print shop at Miller Beach. Lucky for him, little Art never told his mother about discovering that his father was counterfeiting again. "I was angry and I wanted to scare him, but I didn't want him to go back to prison," he says. Art had taken care of today. Now all he had to do was figure out how to support 4 kids and himself. A few weeks later, he learned that it would be 5 kids when Sarah told him that she was pregnant. Any other time, this might have been purely happy news, but Art quickly became depressed, trying to figure out how he would support the new baby. He did still have his studio space in Lacuna Lofts, but he was out of inspiration. One day when he went there to paint, all he could think about was his predicament. He sat by himself in the lobby, his head in his hands. "Hey, Artie, what's going on with you, man?" came a voice. It was Joe Cacciatore Sr., owner of the Lacuna Lofts and one of the wealthiest men in Chicago. Art hadn't seen the patriarch since he had come with his son Joey Jr. to one of his shows a few months earlier. He'd always liked Joe. Despite his wealth and power, he was humble and never forgot that he came from Bridgeport. For obvious reasons, many of the people Joe interacted with sought to impress him, but Art had never felt that way. "I can't do anything right, Joe. I've failed at everything I've tried. I put in the work, but every time I can't take care of myself or my family, I go off the edge." Joe sat there quietly, thinking, while Art struggled to control his emotions. "I got an idea," Joe finally said. The resident artists visiting the Lofts over the next 6 months would be painting murals and working with the community, and it was important that they had someone who understood them and could help them realize their visions and goals. This wasn't charity. Like all professionals, artists can be exacting and demanding and quirky. With their long history as patrons of the arts, the Cacciatores knew the difference between tossing money at artists and nurturing them. Joe asked Art if he could live off of $5,000 a month doing this. With tears in his eyes, Art told him yes. Art spent the next 6 months as a paid intern, doing everything from coffee runs and sourcing supplies to showing visitors the town. Lacuna's guests included heavy hitters like Ford Smith, Jeff Blackburn, and Wordsmith. "It was the greatest apprenticeship I could ever have had," says Art. "I was still a prison artist, and they were all badasses. I got to see how they work. I worked on every mural they did." After the Lacuna gig ended, Art's old friend Eric Reed helped him secure a well-paying job painting houses. Art would paint houses all day, then return to the studio to paint his canvases. His painting, still mostly anchored in the currency designs that he loved, not only evolved, but he also got faster. He taught himself how to paint with both hands and move between several canvases while his paints set. One of the tropes he loved to play with was to incorporate pop culture and celebrities into the bills that he painted. Playful, almost Warhol-esque references like Marilyn Monroe or Al Capone. These were done with such meticulous detail that the natural reaction for viewers would be, "Well, why the hell shouldn't they be on American money?" All this time, Art remained close to Joey Jr., and in March of 2016, the Cacciatores invited him to show his work at Columbia College on South Wabash Street. Then, as it always did, life tested him. House painting jobs dried up in winter, and Art, who now had an infant son that he and Sarah named Da Vinci, got laid off. Then he lent his car to a friend who totaled it, and just weeks after that, an electrical fire broke out in their apartment. After the Chicago Fire Department doused the flames, almost all their possessions were lost. "You know, I've stood in front of judges and got time," Art recalls. I've seen people get really hurt bad. I never really knew what shock was until I walked into my house that was fucking burnt and destroyed. All that was left worth salvaging was a charred canvas that Art had been working on as a tribute to his brother, along with a paintbrush. Losing his job, his car, and his home was the universe knocking at his door, telling him to start counterfeiting again. But this time, he didn't. The paintbrush had survived. After the fire, Eric Reed told an acquaintance of his, Frank Girolamo, that his friend Art was looking for work. Frank was the president of an insurance advocacy company that helped people assert their insurance claims and also restored damaged property. When Frank heard about Art's recent troubles, he offered him odd jobs at the company's work sites, mostly in construction. Around this same time, Bill Shapiro, the former editor of Life magazine, was writing a book called What We Keep, and was interviewing all kinds of people about the single most meaningful object in their possession. He reached out to Art to discuss his paintbrush. Art excitedly told Frank about how the interview had reinvigorated his dreams. More than ever, he wanted to paint full-time. "Well, what if I paid you a salary to paint? Gave you a space here in the office," Frank said. For the past few months, he had been quietly watching Art break his back at the construction sites, then go home every night to paint. He was impressed with Art's work ethic and his paintings, and had attended a couple small showings. You don't even know me that well," Art said, tearing up. You'd do that for me?" "Just paint," Frank told him. "If it doesn't work out, we can always go back to painting houses." Frank set Art up in his company's training room and equipped him with a full set of paints, a computer, and a printer. Art was so nervous that he couldn't paint anything for 2 days. "Am I any good? Do I even know what I'm doing? I was in my head," he says. When he finally set paint to canvas, he stuck mainly to his celebrity bills, this time marrying them with the currency in increasingly unique ways, blending faces together, adding interference patterns, creating reverse images so the paintings resembled photolithographic plates, and even experimenting with color shifting and ultraviolet inks. Another one of his signature themes was currency in the form of puzzle pieces, an homage to his experience of unlocking the security secrets of the 1996 new note. After a few months, Art's repertoire was building, so Frank, who had become his de facto manager, worked on getting him his own show. Art may have been an infamous counterfeiter, but he was completely unknown as an artist. The first person Frank found was a local boxing promoter named Bobby Hitz, who said Art could display some paintings at an upcoming match in Elk Grove. "It was like at a banquet hall," Frank remembers. "They gave us a corner to display a few pieces. Of course, hardly any people looked at our stuff because they were all interested in the boxing. But we didn't get discouraged, we just kept on moving." After 6 months and a few more small shows, Art and Frank were getting anxious. They wanted to show his work to a bigger audience. One of Art's friends knew someone who could get Art wall space at the annual Art Basel Fair in Miami for $1,500. Now, most artists don't pay to show their work at Art Basel, but Frank happily admits that when it came to the art business, we had no idea what the fuck we were doing. Art loaded up one of Frank's vans with paintings and drove straight from Chicago to Miami. Art had his first doubts when he dropped his works off at the gallery, which was 2 miles from the convention center. Despite the fact that Frank and Art were paying for wall space, the gallery put his work in a back corner. But he was excited to be there, and when Frank flew down the next day to join him, they met the man who had hooked Art up with the gallery space. His name was Joe Benson, and he ran an executive jet rental business in Miami. Joe offered to get Art and Frank into some of the shows he was attending so they could network. Art and Frank were excited until they attended their first show. The artist's works turned out to be eerily similar to Art's. He painted $100 bills. Many were so alike in color and concept that Art immediately became suspicious. I just had a feeling like this dude had been watching me on my social media, and since he's in Miami, he could get away with it and sell it down there, Art says. Meanwhile, I'm sitting here with nothing. I remember just feeling like complete shit. It was the first, but far from the last time, that Art would find surprising parallels between the art business and the counterfeiting business. The possibility that he was being counterfeited left him inherently conflicted. He was despondent, yet also saw it as a compliment. Biting their tongues, Art and Frank even met the artist and his manager. I felt like they knew who I was, Art says. That night, Art walked by himself for hours on Ocean Boulevard, wondering if he was played out as a painter. Then at 3 a.m, he got a call from Joe Benson. "Look, I feel bad about what happened today," Benson told Art. "Why don't we throw you your own event tomorrow afternoon at the jet hangar where I work?" The next morning, Art hustled to retrieve his canvases from the gallery and rent easels to display them at the jet hangar, while Frank and Joe Benson called everyone they knew in Miami. To help sweeten the pot, the event would be a charity auction, with half of the proceeds from Art's work going to After School All-Stars, a charity that provides free after-school programs for underprivileged youth. Benson's hangar was at the Miami Opa-locka Executive Airport. Art set his paintings up in front of a private jet, and then waited in the expansive clubhouse next door, which had a full bar with couches and chairs. Frank and Joe even hired a DJ, but a half hour after the party was supposed to start, not a soul was there. Art, feeling pessimistic again, stepped outside of the hangar to smoke a cigarette. "All of a sudden, a Ferrari pulls up," he remembers. "Then a big-ass limo truck, followed by all these badass cars." Within an hour, 100 people filled the clubhouse. As the cars indicated, the guests were well-heeled. A day earlier, no one knew Art existed, and now everybody was talking about the paintings and everyone wanted to meet Artie, Frank recalls. Prior to the auction, Art took the microphone and shared some of his personal story, telling guests about growing up poor on the South Side, counterfeiting, prison, and his belief that he could change his life. When it was time for the auction, Frank gleefully watched three pieces sell for $18,500. They were purchased by Ed Letko, a medical supplies tycoon from Miami. "Art's paintings are unique, and his story is unique," Letko says. "My wife Anna and I recognized that immediately." Frank looked around for Art, but couldn't see him anywhere. He stepped outside the clubhouse again and began walking down the rows of parked vehicles, and finally found Art between two trucks, sobbing. "Why the hell are you crying?" Frank asked him. "We did it. We just sold your paintings for almost $20,000. "You don't understand where I come from, where I've been," Art said. "That someone like me could become an artist and have people like these come and buy my work? It's beyond anything I had imagined was possible." Frank suddenly understood that Art was crying because he was happy. Well, that made Frank start crying too, and the Chicagoans stood there between the trucks crying and laughing at how improbable it all was. Was it? Art had won an art contest at Eisenhower Academy as a kid by drawing the metaphorical prison cell that he was living in. Pete Da Vinci had surely seen those skills when he was a teenager and trained him to become a master counterfeiter, which, as a man, had led him into very real prison cells. Art had always been gifted and capable of great achievements, but he hadn't known it. "The craziest thing is that I'm still printing and painting money, and I still get the rush," he says. "But now, it's art." And that was an excerpt from The Last Counterfeiter, the story of fake money, real art, and forging the impossible $100 bill, by Jason Kirsten. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College, and this hour we're reading from Rolling Stone magazine. Let's shift now to the music section. Under the subhead Told You So, Chapel Roan won't tempt fate on new single Good Luck, Babe by Brittany Spanos. On TikTok, a fan of Chapel Roan's shared a video of the singer performing Pink Pony Club in 2021 at a Los Angeles fundraiser. Roan is by herself playing the keyboard in front of a small audience and not as glammed up as she is nowadays on stage. Roan's rapidly growing fan base has been stitching this video with their own footage of the 26-year-old playing the song 3 years later, this time either while opening for friend Olivia Rodrigo in arenas or for one of her own sold-out headlining shows. "I'm just really proud of everyone who stuck with it. I'm proud of myself for sticking with it," she tells Rolling Stone, not long before her final show on the Guts World Tour. At the time the viral video was shot, Roan was working at a donut shop and had been dropped from her first recording contract. "I couldn't tell how I was going to make it work, but I did. So being on the Olivia tour feels natural and right. It doesn't feel out of reach. I'm just so grateful for everyone who stuck around." Now, Roan has released the first song of her next chapter, as she calls it. Good Luck, Babe was written by Daniel Nigro and Justin Tranter and is about wishing good luck to someone who is denying fate. On the song, Roan is dating a girl who is trying to deny her own feelings for Roan and likely for women altogether. "You can kiss 100 boys in bars, shoot another shot, try to stop the feelings," she belts in falsetto on the chorus. "I was just wanting to write a big anthemic pop song," she says. "The song was a bitch to write." The trio worked on the tracks for months before finally working on The Raging Bridge, a big 90s pop moment from Roan that predicts the regret her negligent partner will face one day. "I knew exactly what I wanted. I wrote it in 3 minutes," she recalls. I felt so much anger. I was so upset. It all came out, and I didn't add anything when I wrote it all down. It was a perfect storm." As for whether Good Luck, Babe kicks off a new album cycle for Roan, she's still not sure yet. She did know that she wanted to avoid making an expanded version of The Rise and Fall of the Midwest Princess, especially since she had been living with some of the songs on that album since 2020. "I did not want to make a deluxe of the album. I only want one. I don't want to deal with two versions. I was like, let's just move on. We'll just put out a song that I love. That's how I did it last time." Over the past few months, it seems like Roan and Midwest Princess are both just really getting started. Rodrigo's tour has been one major part of that, with Roan playing the biggest venues of her career so far. "It's different, but not that different," she says of the Guts tour. "There's a lot more younger girls than at my shows, but the best audience ever is teenage girls." Roan's own captivating style of live performance is what's been getting her the most traction online lately. Her NPR Tiny Desk set, where she belted out a few of her best-known numbers in full Midwestern pageant princess drag, was a major viral moment for Roan. "I felt like a big girl pop star," she says of the appearance. "I don't read comments, so all I really know is that my mom is really excited. I read maybe 3 comments, and one was, 'Why did she let a drag queen do her makeup?' And I was like, 'Oh, they're new here.'" Though Roan is chipping away in the studio with Nigro whenever inspiration strikes, she still has a lot more touring coming up. A mix of headline shows and festival dates have packed her schedule through the summer, and she's finding it hard to consume or think about more music outside of when she's working enough as it is. The most she's been consuming these days, she says, is Japanese electone player Sekito Shigeo, Drag Race, and whatever the YouTube algorithm recommends to her. She hasn't even had time yet to work on a video for Good Luck, Babe, though she is considering filming one in June. "I'm not forcing anything, and I don't feel pressure from myself to get an album done as fast as possible," she adds. Just as her debut album made its Billboard 200 debut 6 months after its release. "If we get to an album, that's great." Solar Eclipse skyrockets Total Eclipse of the Heart streams by 480%. By Ethan Millman. Monday's solar eclipse caused a major flare-up on streams for Bonnie Tyler's Total Eclipse of the Heart, with streams on the song jumping about 486% from Sunday versus Monday, according to data from Luminate. In the 10 days prior to the solar eclipse, the song was averaging about 233,000 streams per day, and on Sunday it had about 307,000 streams. Then on Monday alone, Total Eclipse of the Heart saw about 1.8 million streams per Luminate. Outside of streams, sales jumped too, with the song topping the iTunes chart on Monday as well, per Forbes. Meanwhile, Jimmy Fallon covered the song on the NBC rooftop on Monday, alongside Heart's Anne and Nancy Wilson. Monday's eclipse was a rare, momentous occasion that brought thousands outside, some venturing around the country to witness the event. It'll be another 20 years before most of the United States can witness the next eclipse, though for those willing to travel to Greenland, there will be another eclipse in 2026. While many on Monday merely enjoyed the opportunity to witness the rare cosmic phenomenon, right-wing conspiracy theorists made ludicrous claims online that the Biden administration was using the eclipse as a chance to shut down cell phone service, while other religious zealots said the occurrence marked a time to repent and follow Donald Trump. CMT Music Awards go big in Texas with questionable results. By Joseph Hudak. As Willie Nelson once sang, there is no place but Texas, and some of country music's Hallmark Awards shows seem to agree. In the past 2 years, two big budget ceremonies have been staged not in Nashville, but in the Lone Star State. On Sunday, the CMT Music Awards, airing on CBS, made their return to Austin for a second consecutive year and leaned hard into all the trappings of Texas. Native son Cody Johnson opened the show with an Everything Is Bigger performance of a song called That's Texas. Cowboy hats were ubiquitous, including on host Kelsey Ballerini, who donned Barbie's pink Western getup for a skit. Even the Bucky's Beaver, the mascot of the beloved Texas convenience store chain, made an appearance, sidling up next to Keith Urban during a goofy segment about reading artists' minds. Perhaps the move to Texas and the celebration of all its imagery is a way of acknowledging the state's status and that of nearby Oklahoma as the current hotbed of country music. Few scenes in Nashville and beyond are as vibrant and exciting as the red-hot, red-dirt movement presently transforming once regional names like Parker McCollum, who performed on the CMT Awards, and Zach Bryan, who did not, into mainstream stars. But as it turns out, transporting a longtime Nashville production to Texas can only do so much. Despite its second year at the Moody Center in Austin, the CMT Music Awards occasionally struggled to find its footing. On one hand, there were moments that rivaled anything seen on a country awards show stage in the past 10 years. Trisha Yearwood's live debut of her instant classic, Put It in a Song, was sublime. The tribute to Toby Keith by Brooks and Dunn, Lainey Wilson, and in particular Sammy Hagar, deftly threaded the needle between reverent and rowdy. And Little Big Town and Sugar Land's Heavenly Union on Phil Collins's Take Me Home reminded many of us how sweet it is to hear expert singers ply their trade. We already cannot wait for that tour this fall. McCollum's performance of his radio hit, Burn It Down, rendered as a collab with Brittany Spencer, who also was a win, even if Spencer was relegated to a special guest role. And a cameo by Melissa Etheridge, who darted onto the stage to sing Come to My Window with the ebullient Ballerini, was inspired nostalgic fun. But other set pieces left us scratching our heads, specifically when the action shifted across town to the University of Texas at Austin for performances by Jason Aldean, Bailey Zimmerman, Old Dominion, and more. Right after Johnson's live show opening, the music continued with a pre-taped performance by Aldean of his song, Let Your Boys Be Country. Immediately, the framing of the campus's imposing tower behind him, bathed in red and blue lights, called to mind the Tennessee courthouse setting of Aldean's controversial video for Try That in a Small Town, a music video depicting scenes of protests that CMT refused to play. Unlike that fear-mongering song, Let Your Boys Be Country is a benign lesson in country manners and coming of age, but it was hard to miss a similarity in the production. Even more questionable, however, was the decision to film multiple performances in front of the University of Texas's tower at all, where, in 1966, a gunman opened fire from its observation deck, killing 14 people. That was 58 years ago, and to many fans watching the awards, it's ancient history. But Route 91 is not. Considering that the largest mass shooting in modern American history happened at a country music festival in 2017, while Aldean was on stage, the tower setting deserved a second thought. But in the end, the CMT Awards have always strived to promote unity and spotlight diversity, especially over the past few years. On Sunday, they tapped four black women who sang on Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter album, Tanner Adele, Tierra Kennedy, Raina Roberts, and Spencer, to present an award. It was a nice moment of recognition, but it was also the night's only mention of country's biggest story, even as Beyoncé just became the first black woman to score a number one country album. That felt like a missed opportunity to shine light on a watershed moment in country's history. Even more, why not use that moment to give performance slots to some or all of Adele, Kennedy, Roberts, and Spencer? It can be really hard to stand up for what is right and what you believe in, Yearwood said earlier in the evening while accepting the inaugural June Carter Cash Humanitarian Award. Love one another. Not just say it, but let's actually go out there and do it. Inside Jimmy Buffett's tribute concert, McCartney, margaritas, and one hell of a parrot head party. By John Lonsdale. Good evening, Hollywood fucking bowl, Paul McCartney exclaimed to the flock of parrot heads gathered before him. A sold-out crowd had assembled in the famed Los Angeles venue on Thursday to celebrate the legacy of Jimmy Buffett at Keep the Party Going, a laid-back, one-night-only tribute show full of eclectic guests. I had the great pleasure of knowing Jimmy, and like everyone else on the bill tonight, I said, this is one great man. He was generous, he was funny, he'd done just about everything in his life, McCartney said, before launching into Let It Be. It was a song that McCartney said he'd played for Buffett at his home during the final week of his life. Buffett died on September 1, 2023, at 76, after a battle with Merkel cell skin cancer. This being a Buffett tribute, however, any poignancy took a backseat to the party. The show officially kicked off at 7 p.m., but in the Parrothead time zone, it was perpetually 5 o'clock somewhere. Outside the gates, a sea of fans had donned their best tropical shirts, captain caps, and the occasional parrot accessory to get the festivity started. Even security was wearing Lays. Along with the stacked musical lineup, Keep the Party Going, a tribute to Jimmy Buffett, featured introductions, some via video, some in person, from Dolly Parton, James Taylor, Woody Harrelson, Pat Riley, and Dave Matthews. Harrison Ford was there in the flesh. There's no other way to say it. There will never be another like Jimmy, Ford told the crowd, before introducing the Zac Brown Band as one of Jimmy's favorite and most frequent collaborators. The group jammed through the new track, Pirates and Parrots, out April 19th, and their collab with Buffett, Knee Deep, with Brown literally taking off his pants to play the song in shorts and a tee, backed by Buffett's Coral Reefer Band. Mac McAnally, a longtime member of the Coral Reefer Band, introduced Eric Church, who delivered one of the standout performances of the night, as well as one of Buffett's finest quotes. "Jimmy enjoyed living life more than any person enjoyed living life," the country star said. "I can remember we were hiking one day, and we were heading up this vista, and we started talking about music and songwriting and our careers and his life and my life and death. And, you know, Eric," Jimmy said, "guys like us, we don't really die," he said, "because the songs live forever." "And this one will," Church said, as the opening chords to "Son of a Son of a Sailor" rang out over the bowl, and an image of a sailboat drifting along the water was projected on a screen behind the musicians. Later, a projection of the Arc de Triomphe appeared behind Jackson Browne as he sang his stirring rendition of "He Went to Paris," one of Buffett's greatest cuts from 1973's "A White Sport Coat and a Pink Crustacean." In the latter half, the set list shifted to songs that Buffett wasn't exactly known for. Snoop Dogg took the stage for a performance of "Gin and Juice," alongside psychedelic visuals of Buffett in the 2019 Matthew McConaughey film, The Beach Bum. And Pitbull appeared to perform his own "Don't Stop the Party," before being joined by John Bon Jovi for "Thank God" and Jimmy Buffett. Sheryl Crow, who delivered an audience participation rendition of "Fins," recalled adventures with Buffett and being hired by him when she was absolutely a nobody to sing backup on his 1989 album, Off to See the Lizard. "Buffett is, for me, the most beautiful illustration of what it means to be alive and awake and absolutely present in every moment," Crow said. For the home stretch, Don Johnson, no stranger to pastels and warm weather vibes from his Miami Vice days, called to the stage a bunch of guys they used to hang out with back in the day, and introduced the Eagles. Led by Don Henley and Joe Walsh, the California Icons played their own miniature set featuring Henley's "The Boys of Summer" and the band's "Take It to the Limit" and "In the City." The Eagles hung around to back up McCartney on the Beatles' "Let It Be." But there's only one way a tribute to Buffett can end, however, and Sir Paul knew it. Grabbing a margarita, he joined the Coral Reefer Band and the tribute's cast for a Margaritaville finale. "Jimmy Buffett, get a big kick out of this," McAnally said. "Raise a glass. Show 'em how to do it." Wow, what a way to go, huh? This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College. And this is the Rolling Stone Show. We're about to flip over now to the politics section. Trump, Johnson announced redundant proof of citizenship bill to vote. By Nikki McCann Ramirez and Charisma Matarang. Donald Trump and now Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican of Louisiana, have endorsed a bill that would ban non-citizens from voting in federal elections, a thing that is already illegal. If you haven't already guessed, the legislation is a brazen stunt intended to gin up public support for a former president campaigning on an anti-immigration platform and a House Speaker on the brink of being ousted by extremists in his caucus. No state allows non-citizens to vote in federal or state elections, but there are limited instances in which residents who have not yet been naturalized are allowed to vote in local elections. But for years now, Republicans have been pushing conspiracy theories like the Great Replacement, which holds that Democrats and a cabal of shady, unseen political forces are importing immigrants in mass to vastly shift the electoral makeup of the country and seize permanent control of the government. In the aftermath of the 2020 election, Trump and his allies have heavily promoted baseless claims of electoral fraud, as well as false assertions that elections are vulnerable to interference by non-citizen voters. On Friday, Johnson traveled to Florida to meet with Trump for a joint press conference at his Mar-a-Lago resort. Johnson declared that House Republicans will be introducing a bill that will require proof of citizenship to vote. What we're going to do is introduce legislation to require every single person who registers to vote in a federal election must prove that they are an American citizen first. You have to prove it, he continued, touting the bill under the rationale of election integrity. The shameless posturing over the unnecessary legislation becomes even more egregious when one remembers that in February, House Republicans set aside their self-proclaimed commitment to locking down the border and reforming the nation's immigration laws in favor of giving the legislative middle finger to the Biden administration. Johnson and his caucus killed a massive bipartisan immigration reform package because the political benefits of continuing to complain about the border outweighed their interest in actually passing laws. Following the Mar-a-Lago meeting, even Fox News called out Johnson's redundancy, pointing out that in 1996, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act. That act makes it explicitly illegal for non-citizens to vote. Johnson is facing significant internal pressure from House Republicans, who are all but screaming that their priority for the next 7 months is ensuring that former President Trump defeats Biden in the general election, even if it means shutting down the government to avoid giving the president any sort of PR win. In March, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate Johnson's speaker position, accusing him in an open letter of having not lived up to a single one of his self-imposed tenets. We could have also taken out funding for abortion and the trans agenda on kids if our own speaker would have allowed us to offer amendments. We could have achieved other worthy victories if we had only put up a fight against Democrats. Instead, Mike Johnson worked with Chuck Schumer rather than with us and gave Joe Biden and the Democrats everything they wanted, no different from how a speaker Hakeem Jeffries would have done, Green wrote. When asked during Friday's press conference if he backed Green's motion to depose Johnson, Trump answered, "We're getting along very well with the speaker, and I get along very well with Marjorie," he continued. "I think he's doing a very good job. He's doing about as good as you're going to do. And I'm sure that Marjorie understands that. She's a very good friend of mine, and I know she has a lot of respect for the speaker. I stand with the speaker. We have had a very good relationship," Trump later added. In uniting with Trump, Johnson is attempting to tie himself to the man Republicans refuse to defy and hopefully save his job. Unfortunately for Johnson, the House GOP has no problem crushing their leadership for sport. Right-wing outlets and influencers sued by man misidentified as mass shooter. By Nikki McCann Ramirez. A man who was falsely accused of carrying out a deadly mass shooting in Allen, Texas, has sued multiple prominent right-wing influencers and conservative media outlets for libel over their coverage of the massacre. According to HuffPost, which first reported the lawsuit, Mauricio Garcia, a 36-year-old Texas resident, has accused Fox News, Televisa Univision, and Newsmax, along with influencers Tim Pool, Steven Crowder, and InfoWars host Owen Schroyer, among others, of having recklessly disregarded basic journalistic safeguards and published the photo of an innocent man, branding him as a neo-Nazi murderer to his local community and the nation at large. In May last year, a gunman shot and killed 8 shoppers at a mall in Allen, Texas. The alleged shooter, later identified as 33-year-old Mauricio Martinez Garcia, was a self-avowed neo-Nazi who espoused racist and violent rhetoric online for months before carrying out the massacre. As networks and online sleuths worked to identify the shooter, the lawsuit alleges that the defendants misidentified Garcia as Martinez Garcia for days, leading to harassment and death threats against an innocent man and his family. The lawsuit accuses Fox News of having used an image of innocent 36-year-old plaintiff Maurizio Garcia to portray the gunman in an article published on their website, and of having refused to retract the article after being notified of their mistake. Additionally, Newsmax is accused of having prominently displayed a misidentified photo of Garcia on multiple shows, and accusing him of being a member of the Puro Tango Blast prison gang. Garcia argues that conspiracy theories spread by the right-wing influencers named in the lawsuit further compounded the wrongful damage to his reputation. In the aftermath of the shooting, prominent conservatives promoted conspiracy theories that Martinez Garcia's extremist ties and the massacre itself were a psyop. The lawsuit accuses Poole, Crowder, and Schroyer of wrongfully using his image in their discussion of the shooting, and in some instances linking him to their conspiracies. Garcia's lawyers allege that Poole's media outfit, Timcast Media Group, Inc., published multiple articles on their website using Garcia's image to portray the gunman. Timcast Media Group also published an episode of Timcast IRL in which the thumbnail image for the video used a photograph of the plaintiff. This image was viewable not only to YouTube users who actually clicked on the video, but to any user who was served the video on their feeds or in a recommendation sidebar, the filing says. In addition, in the following days, Poole continued to cast doubt on the event and tell his audience that the event was a psyop or staged government conspiracy. These allegations amplified the damage to Mr. Garcia. The filing makes similar accusations against Crowder, whose website used a photo of Garcia in an article claiming that the media refuses to share photos of the killer. It's by no means the first time those affected by a mass shooting have sought accountability for reckless coverage of the mass shootings that now plague American life. In 2022, InfoWars founder Alex Jones was ordered to pay more than $1.4 billion in damages to the families of victims killed in the 2012 massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School for his conspiratorial coverage of the shooting. The landmark case marked a drastic change in how third parties can respond to money-grubbing, conspiracy-mongering by prominent media figures in the aftermath of tragedies. Garcia's only sin was to have the same name as the shooter, read a translated message written by Garcia's mother to Univision around the time of the shooting. Univision is also accused of having wrongly used Garcia's image to identify the shooter in their televised coverage of the massacre. Senate Dems finally subpoena Supreme Court Puppet Master by Charisma Matarang and Andrew Perez. Conservative activist Leonard Leo was hit with a subpoena from Senate Democrats on Thursday as part of a probe into Supreme Court ethics and whether individuals or groups used luxury gifts to access justices. The subpoena from the Senate Judiciary Committee arrives months after it was authorized, CNN reported. Mr. Leo has played a central role in the ethics crisis plaguing the Supreme Court, and unlike the other recipients of information requests in this matter, he has done nothing but stonewall the committee. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, the committee's chairman, said in a statement to the outlet. This subpoena is a direct result of Mr. Leo's own actions and choices. Leo is the co-chair of the Federalist Society, the influential conservative lawyers network, and leads a sprawling dark money operation working to influence the courts, politics, and policy. In 2021, Leo was the beneficiary of a historic $1.6 billion dark money donation. He told CNN that he would not comply with the subpoena, calling it unlawful, and the left's dark money effort to silence and cancel political opposition. As Rolling Stone reported in February, Leo has been quietly expanding his dark money network. As Leonard Leo faces increasing scrutiny for his shady nonprofit network, it's no surprise he's desperately trying to rebrand. said Carolyn Ciccone, president at the watchdog group Accountable.us. But no matter how many sketchy new groups he comes up with, he can't rebrand the extreme agenda he's still attempting to force on everyday Americans. During his time as then-President Donald Trump's judicial advisor, Leo helped build the Supreme Court's conservative 6-3 supermajority and select three justices. He did so while leading an outside network that spreads money around to help bring cases before the Supreme Court, determine which cases the justices consider, and influence the court's decisions. The crowning achievement in this strategy was the court's 2022 decision overturning Roe v. Wade, eliminating federal protections for abortion. Over the past year, the Supreme Court has faced unprecedented scrutiny, following reports from ProPublica detailing Justice Clarence Thomas's close relationship with Nazi-obsessed billionaire and GOP donor Harlan Crow, who provided gifts and trips to Thomas that the justice failed to disclose. Leo has played a role in some of these scandals. According to the Washington Post, Leo steered secret consulting payments to Thomas's wife, Ginny. Leo also helped arrange Justice Samuel Alito's seat on a private jet, paid for by a billionaire hedge fund chief, as part of a vacation at an Alaskan luxury fishing lodge, paid for by another conservative donor. Alito did not disclose the private jet flight. And that's going to have to do it for tonight, as we've reached the end of our hour. You've been listening to selected articles from the online edition of Rolling Stone magazine. My name's Steve Godwin, and it's been my pleasure to read them for you. And once again, this is Sun Sounds of Arizona, a public service of Rio Salado College.